And that particular sect says that you are like a kitten and God is like a cat. So God will carry you in his mouth and lead you to liberation. All that you have to do is to believe that you are God, in this case Vishnu, has the power to do and ask for his forgiveness. This is called Marjara Nyaya. Marjara is cat. This is in contrast to other sects which says Marjara Nyaya is wrong. There is Markata Nyaya. Markata is monkey. A monkey does not carry its offspring. The offspring holds on to the monkey. Similarly, in Markata Nyaya, you have to hold on to the divinity, and divinity will not carry you. That's the debate, religious debate between Markata Nyaya and Marjara Nyaya. Similarly, there is in Islam also, I'm sure, I'm not well read into this particular aspect of Islam, but the mercy of Allah being so great, the orthodoxy would certainly claim that if you follow the injunctions of and the rituals of the outer religion, then you can certainly be forgiven your sins. We can go on and on. There are trying to find examples from many religions and various sects in them. But the concept, the reasons that they give to claim such a power to God is that, see, man is weak. In weakness, we commit mistakes. So we must be given a second chance. That's point number one, one kind of argument. And secondly, the belief that my sins can be forgiven, my past can be erased, and I can start afresh. And have a brighter future for myself. And the sins I committed in ignorance and weakness can be erased, and I be not held accountable for it, makes for man's happiness. The great burden, psychological burden, which is removed from his mind. Third argument is that, see, man being so weak, he has the power to forgive his fellow men. A mistake committed by my brother, I forgive him. When that is the situation that man is in, when he has the power to do that, would not God, who is all-wise, omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent, would not God forgive the mistakes of the weak man? That's the third argument. The fourthly, scriptural evidences are given. For example, when crucifixion, when Christ was crucified, what happened in the other two crosses? There were thieves. And what happened to one of them? How he was raised to the empyrean heights of heaven, and so on and so forth. They are similarly in all religions. What we have to look at is objectively seen whether this idea that my mistakes can be erased, whether this idea leads to goodness in man or leads to proliferation of evil in man. What are the consequences of holding on to this idea on myself as well as to the society? That we have to look at. Firstly, in terms of its consequence on my own moral nature. If there is a God who can forgive my sins, it becomes a license to do more evil. Is it not obvious that I can do whatever I want in a fit of anger or a fit of passion, or deliberately, cunningly, using my intelligence, obtain my object of desire? Using unlawful, unethical means by causing great harm to others, and go to the temple or the mosque or the church and perform certain rituals and expiate and erase those sins. If this is the case, what stops me from doing evil again and again? Secondly, in terms of society, its impact on society, the impact of this idea on society itself, where is justice? Where is justice? If we have courts which, irrespective of what is the crime and what the issue is, if the accused can write a petition, let's say a flowerly petition, poetically written, full of emotion and sentiment, pray for forgiveness, and everyone's mistake is thus erased, forgiven, then what is the incentive to be good at all? And without justice in society, where is peace? Where is permanence? Where is happiness? Without justice, a society disintegrates and descends into the worst kind of chaos. In fact, if you look at any of the social movements, whether in the realm of land reforms, in the realm of livelihood, in the domain of water, access to resources, access to temples, any of these you take, it may appear to be different variety of social reforms and social movements, but at the center of it, it is the simple question of justice. When the issue of justice comes, then there's something in man that wakes up, that revolts against injustice, and that fights against it. So this idea leads to injustice, and without injustice, there is no peace, there is no happiness, there is no true progress at all. And further, the society suffers greatly when this idea is held. Take the case of a corrupt politician who amasses wealth by basically destroying the whole of natural resources of the place he belongs to, but goes to the temple and makes a large donation. And he is assured by the priestcraft that his sins will be erased. There is a compensation that he is making, and it will somehow balance out. Or the case of an unethical businessman who amasses wealth by cheating the poor, committing fraud, destroying their livelihood, but pays zakat during Ramzan and hopes that his sins will be forgiven. Or take the case in 19th century where a religious disturbance arose in Spanish American province, and there were clashes, many people died, and on the bodies of those who were dead was found a certain special religious passport issued and signed by the bishop of diocese, which said that, "Dear Peter, please admit this person to heaven, because we assure that he is a true man of the church, he is a true son of the church." The religious clash happened because the priests instigated the mob and instigated the people one against the other, and they killed one another, but they found this kind of peculiar passport to Saint Peter, issued by the priest, issued by the bishop. So HBB writes about this incident and says that they made Saint Peter the janitor of heaven, a certain ticket keeper, a ticket keeper to the Trinity. He was made into a ticket keeper for Trinity. Or take the case of infidels who, when either converted or killed, converted at the fear of the sword or killed, then the person who commits the crime is forgiven and he is led to heaven. We can go on and on about this kind of atrocious consequences of holding a fundamentally wrong idea. See, a tree is known by its fruits, and a doctrine is known by the society it makes. So we must judge a doctrine by the kind of moral consequences and the practical results that it bears upon the society that we are in. So religion becomes a kind of, in most cases, a kind of compromise between man's highest ideals and his in the weaknesses of his nature. So religion enters into arena between these two things and comes out with fantastic ideas and makes a compromise and says that, you know, you just make obeisance to me, the religious institution, and then I will take care of your celestial future. So it's very important that we hold correct fundamental ideas, because it is these fundamental views which Buddha calls in one of his sutras as ditti or drishti, that affects our thinking or chitta and eventually affects our very perception of the world, which is sanna. So if our views are distorted or perverted, then our thinking is perverted. When our thinking is perverted, our perception is perverted. When the perceptions are perverted, we act along wrong lines, and it is our action, thought, motive which is making our destiny. So the destiny of humankind depends upon the ideas that we hold. And therefore, all true teachers come to give out the right ideas, replace the old ideas with the right ideas, and focus on liberating the mind from the clutches of ignorance and wrong thinking. This is true philanthropy, philanthropy of the highest sort, when we are able to help in soul evolution, when we help in disseminating the right ideas, which leads to the freedom of the soul and restoring the divine stature of man, making him responsible being and making him realize his grand destiny before him and the divine origin that he has had. This is what all true teachers do. They don't come to establish religions or institutions or sects or even social and other laws. You know, they are all secondary and tertiary issues. Central issue is the ideas that we hold, and there we have to focus. Now, coming to science, let's see what science, how science deals with this whole issue at all. When we say science, we are talking of science as we understand today in its present form. Because there have been sciences in the past which were of a different nature, which had different fundamental propositions than the science of today. So the science of today says that I am immoral. I recognize no morality at all. Because I recognize only matter as it exists today. I mean, as I can see, feel, touch, hear, taste, smell, whatever I can do with these five senses, that alone is real for me. And in my investigation of these laws, I mean, this physical nature, the mystery that is there around me, I do find that there are laws which are immutable. The world functions based on laws, L-A-W-S. And I investigate these laws and put them to use, science and technology. And that's all I'm concerned about. Anything that transcends this empirical realm doesn't even exist for me. It doesn't exist for me at all. So science says that there are causes. Every phenomena can be traced back to its appropriate causes and conditions. True, very scientific, but it does not recognize anything beyond matter, physical matter. So morality is merely a human conception. It's in a way a derivation of chemistry for science. Because if you look at the classification of sciences, chemistry is at the center. See, chemistry comes from physics. Physics comes from mathematics and ratiocination, or the ability to think rationally, right? But from chemistry, there are branches which arise. One branch is the xenosciences and environmental sciences. The second branch is brain sciences and medical sciences. Third branch is nanosciences and computer science and engineering. All these three branches feed finally into socioeconomic sciences, and the derivation of socioeconomic sciences is ethics and laws. So it's all a function of chemistry for science. But there are so many mysteries which remain unresolved only because science holds on to its materialistic monism. That is the idea that matter is all that there is, and matter also being what I see, touch, hear, feel, smell and taste. So there are laws, but only empirical. That's the basic position of science. And religion, on the other hand, recognizes that there are trans-empirical realms. It speaks of various, for example, lokas, or various entities such as archangels and so on and so forth. Many religions speak of many kinds of things which are invisible and beyond physical, but it does not recognize laws. Science recognizes laws, but sticks its, you know, narrows down itself to physics only. Religion recognizes something metaphysical, but unfortunately has lost touch with the scientific rigor and the recognition of laws and rules as stringent as the laws of physics on this world in the trans-empirical world also. So both of them have half-truths, and both of them fight one against the other. But the truth is somewhere in the middle, and which transcends both these perspectives. And that is that not only is the physical realm, this physical world that we perceive is not the only reality. There are other more real realms, the most important of which is the morality, the moral realm. And in every one of these realms, whatever they may be, there are as immutable, unchanging, ever-active function of laws. There are laws which are studied in physics, chemistry, and so on. Similarly, there are laws which can be studied, understood, and put to use on the inner realms. It's not governed by the whims and fancy of any god or archangel or any set of entities to whom we have to pray, but it is immutable and rigid justice. There is a certain basic order in the universe, and the order runs through the most ethereal, invisible, spiritual, down to the most material, physical, and terrestrial. The physical terrestrial is what science investigates, but there are more important realms, just as there are more important aspects in man than merely his biological functions. There are other faculties in man, there are other powers in man. Similarly, correspondingly, there are worlds and realms, and in each of these, supreme governance is that of law, L-A-W, law. So the basically, what we can understand from this is that our life with all its circumstances, with all the opportunities, fortunes and misfortunes, is not the result of either accident, neither is it the result of a divine providence, but it is a function of this law of harmony, which either we break or we adhere to. Either we act in accordance with it and produce harmony, which results in peace, happiness and progress, or we thwart it, as Lord Buddha says, and he who thwarts it loses, as he says. We disturb the basic harmony, or we work in accordance with it. Now, the moment we say this, which the ancient called as the law of karma, the mistake that we do is to make that law of karma also something outside of man. Because we are so habituated to thinking that there is a God outside, and we come across the law of karma in whenever we come across it in our life, we replace that idea of God with the law of karma and transfer all the attributes of that God to that law of karma also. It's a very mistaken notion that the law is outside of us, who there is a law which is looking at us, extra cosmic law which looks at us and then delivers to us rewards and punishments. There is no such thing. Our very existence, our very self is law. Where is the law of karma? Our very innermost essence is that law of karma. With our mistaken ideas, mistaken conceptions of life, when we think, feel, speak and act, either it is in accordance with that law of harmony, which is our innermost self, or we break it. And where is escape from yourself? When you are the law of karma in your innermost essence, where is there an escape to it? So, this is a fundamental idea that we have to keep in mind. Now, coming to the idea of justice and mercy, the human, in our ordinary human conception, justice and mercy are opposites, are they not? A judge can either be merciful and reduce the punishment or altogether dismiss the case of the criminal, or he can be just and render absolute justice and punish the criminal, right? That's the conception of justice, I mean human conception of justice and mercy. But in the divine conception of this law of harmony, justice and mercy are two aspects of the same, which appears very paradoxical if we look at it superficially. But there is great underlying truth in the idea that justice and mercy are aspects of this law of karma or the law of justice. How is it so? That we have to inquire. Why we are going through all this, thinking through all these things, is this is what will help us answer the question which is the title of our talk. Does God have the right to forgive? It is justice. This law is justice because it is mathematically precise. Humans can make errors, but you don't find errors in the laws of nature, right? And in the rules of mathematics. Somewhat analogous to that is what happens and is the real condition of the world in its inner nature also. In its innermost essence, there is harmony, mathematically precise justice, which is working. So it is justice in the sense that I receive the effects of exact result of my own past thoughts, words and deeds. Not only am I held responsible for my physical acts, but I am held responsible, more responsible for what happens in my mind, the motives I hold, the feelings that I have, the intention with which I act. That, the teacher says, is more potent than outward action that we find, that we see, and that we can perceive. It's not the bodily acts alone that I'm held responsible for, but my thinking, my intention, my feelings. There is the true power of my act, and that is where I produce the greatest, that I expend my greatest force. So, as the Jainas say, it is not himsa alone to which you are held responsible for. More important is the himsa sankalpa, that is the intention to do harm, the thinking ill of others. That dynamic power of human mind is expended like a dynamo. It bursts and produces such consequences on the inner plane. If only we were able to see that, we would be terrified of it. We would be terrified of the power that we have and the destructive power of our thoughts. So, it is mathematically precise and just because I am held responsible for the innermost intention which I have. And secondly, this law is justice because nothing can deviate its course. There is no power, there is no entity, there is no God or devil which has the power to deviate the course of karmic law. As Buddha says, tomorrow it will judge, or after many days. We are reminded of the incident in Mahabharata where Gandhari, after losing all her children, blames Krishna of injustice. And she says that, I went back 5 lives, 10 lives, 25 lives, 50 lives past my prior births, 50 prior births, and examined every act of mine, but did not find a single act in which the consequence of which would result in this great disaster I have now find myself in, great misfortune that I am now experiencing. So Krishna says, you should not have stopped at the 50th birth. Go to the 51st birth and you will find that you have created causes, the effect of which has put you in this pitiable condition. So this idea that I will be held responsible, if not tomorrow, at the most appropriate moment, that is justice. You can escape from eyes of the human law, which only sees actions. But how can you escape from the witness who is there within you, who sees and notes everything and records everything, where the law of karma operates from within outwards? Where is escape from that? And thirdly, it is justice because my destiny is not dependent on any other person, any other agency, any other entity, but my destiny is in my own hands, if only I recognize it and act accordingly. I have the power to set in causes motion which will change my future. I need not pray. I need not ask for forgiveness. I have the power to change myself. I have the power to set in motion causes which will result in the future that I have in mind. What can be more justice? What can be more just and fair and honorable than this? But it is mercy also, because if I have done committed a mistake in the past, a crime in the past, if I have harmed someone, of course I will have to face the consequences of it. But the consequences come to me not as a punishment, however painful the circumstances may be, however dire my condition may be. The effects that I am facing do not come to me as a punishment, but it comes to me as an opportunity. It's an opportunity to undo the error of the past. It's an opportunity to learn the lesson that life is teaching by bringing the consequences of my own actions to me, by bringing the fruit of the tree, of the seed that I sown and the tree that I tended in the past. It brings the consequences in such a manner that it brings about my greatest soul evolution. It may be an opportunity to develop soul power, to develop patience, to develop empathy. It is only when we experience that pain that we begin to question and we begin to develop. We begin to develop a different kind of thinking. So it does not come to punish me, but it brings me the fruits of my own action to show me, to help me to develop discrimination. Discrimination between right and wrong. Discrimination between what sets me free and what binds me. This is why Seneca, the great Stoic, made a very important, very interesting statement. He says that pain is slight if opinion adds nothing to it. Pain is slight if opinion adds nothing to it. The opinion that we have is circumstances of life, whatever I do, whatever comes to me, is accidental and I did not deserve it. That's an opinion only. But examination of the laws of life show there can be no such thing as accident. There can be no such thing as a mistaken, for example, I sow a mango seed and I get a sitaphal fruit. There is no such thing that can happen. If my present is painful, it's an opportunity for me to learn, to take responsibility, to understand this law of karma and set about making causes which lead to better future. I have that power. I don't need to pray to God. There is no such God who is out there to listen. As Buddha says, pray not, the darkness will not brighten. The silence will not answer you. Praying is something like asking. For example, I pray to space, saying that, oh space, oh Lord space, I am poor and miserable, build me a house. Does that impersonal space take any cognizance? Doesn't it appear very absurd? So it is mercy because it brings about my soul evolution. The situation that we are in is the best possible thing for us. If only we change our attitude towards it. If our attitude is filled with negativity or complaint, then to a large extent we have missed the lesson that we have to learn. The resistance against circumstances of life creates more trouble, because on the plane of the mind I am generating causes of anger and resentment and non-acceptance, instead of eating the fruit of the tree that I myself, that is there in my own backyard, in my garden, and learning what are the seeds that I have to sow for the future. And further, no circumstance of life, however painful it is, can come to me which has the power to overwhelm me. It is only according to the strength that we have that the merciful, compassionate aspect of the law of karma will present to us the opportunities, present to us the consequences of our own action. It will never present to us something which will overwhelm and destroy us, because that would never serve the purpose of my evolution as a spiritual being. So innumerable opportunities are given to us, life after life, to recognize this law, take the destiny in our own hand and guide it for a higher, better future. And this idea that somebody can erase the past appears very absurd, because just take the simple example of throwing the stone into the pond. Disturbance is created, ripples are created, and it seems some scientists say that any act once done will have its perennial effects in the cosmos of cause and effect, and it can ultimately be traced, every act can be ultimately traced to some previous cause, right? Every phenomena can be traced to its some deep prior cause. So the idea that a god or any entity can erase my action and forgive my sins is similar to saying that a stone has been thrown into the pond, but due to some physical mechanism or through some physical machine, I am able to remove all the expended energy that went out of my hand through the stone into the air and then into the pond. All the disturbance has been collated back, and the stone has been sent back into my hand, and the intention with which I threw the stone into the pond also has been erased. So it is a redrawing of energy as well as erasing of time. And what about the consequences of somebody who saw me throw the stone into the pond and he also threw? That also has to be erased. So it's the impossibility of it is seen in a mere physical example. The absurdity of it. And the teacher gives another important point about why such an idea is mistaken. Look at this. If I commit murder and in the jail, I repent and then fervently pray to the God, saying that I believe in the blood of Christ, or in I perform some Homa and Havan or any such religious modalities that may be there according to my own belief, then I am forgiven by the God. Then is it not better that I become a murderer than a victim? Because the victim, the poor fellow, had no chance to repent for his life, because I took his life. But me, on the other hand, a criminal, a murderer, is forgiven and sent to heaven, and I had this opportunity to repent only because I committed murder, and therefore becoming a murderer is better. It leads to all these absurd ideas. All this is because religion has been hijacked by vested interests. No true teacher, whether it is Jesus or Upanishads or any of them, spoke of any such thing. Scriptures have been altered and fantastic dogmas have been hoisted on the scriptures. Whereas the true teachers say that we are responsible for our own action and consequences of our action, and we have the power to change. We have the power to create a better future. There are some examples of how this is found in Ramayana. I will quote this and then we will open the floor for any discussion. This is from Yuddhakanda, 113th Adhyaya, where Ravan has been killed by Rama, and Hanuman is sent as a messenger to the garden where Sita is held captive. And Hanuman comes and convinces Sita that Rama is still alive and Ravan is no more. And looking at the condition of Sita Mata, he says, "Mother, you have been tortured by these rakshasis, these demonesses, wicked women, for so long. And now is the time to retaliate. You just give me the word. I will break their bones, break their neck and behead them. Just say yes, and I will teach them a lesson, because they have harmed you, and they have put you to such misery." Sita's response is true Vedic culture. Sita's response is true Indian culture. It contains the essence of understanding of the law of karma, which is fundamental to Vedic philosophy when it is rightly understood. Sita says, "Hanuman, how can you even think of such an action? How did this thought even arise in your mind? Do you think this poor demon woman, this wicked, whom you call as wicked woman, do you think they are the ones who tormented me and tortured me? No, Hanuman, not at all. It is through them that my own past sins have reached me. They are merely the mediums, the agents, and they are just following the command of their king. But it is my past sins which has visited me through them. Don't hold them accountable. Have mercy towards them." This is the culture of India. So we'll stop here and take up any questions or any points for discussion.
Am I audible?
Yes, you are audible.
Yeah. About the dogma of vicarious atonement, HBB quotes in the key, she quotes the saying of Jesus and also Saint Paul. What Jesus says in both Mark and Matthew, that as you sow, no, he says, with what measure you meet, it will be measured unto you again, heaped up, pressed down, and running over. After quoting this, she says, this does not approve of or supportive of the dogma of vicarious atonement at all. And again, Saint Paul, "Be not mocked. As you sow, so you reap. God is not deceived." See, all this is clear teaching of the great teachers, but established religions, they're all, you know, this establishment has become vested interest of priests. And then another thing is, one of the laws of karma says, see, the thing is, can God forgive sins? In that question, itself is absurd, because it assumes that there is some extra cosmic God who can give you boon and forgive your sins. That assumption itself is wrong, is it not? Now, one of the laws of karma, the 31 laws of karma, one of the laws of karma says, there is an undeviating, unerring the universe to restore disturbed harmony. And during the process of this restoration of disturbed harmony, the person or the persons, the souls which caused the disturbance, through whom the restoration of harmony takes place, feels pleasure or pain, happiness or sorrow, according as the nature of the cause they set in motion. So in this is the most scientific and absolutely just, reasonable doctrine. And the key, it is said, this law is absolute wisdom, intelligence, and equity. And Plato says, justice is the attribute of human soul. It is not something outside of us. Our higher ego is the inner ruler, who is called Yama. Yama, the inner ruler, is a very embodiment of justice. We ourselves are the very embodiment of justice. So this is just a supplement to what our friend gave out in a very, very nice talk. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Yamala. The two points comes to mind about the gods, and no such god can exist at all in any kind of analysis. I am reminded of what Proclus says. It seems Proclus was asked to attend the public worship of the gods, and he proudly is said to have responded saying, "I will not go to them. It is for them to come to me." That is, he recognizes that the divinity within him is far higher than any of the invisible entities that we may recognize and mistakenly worship as gods. And secondly, the mischievous and the most corrupt influence of religious institutions in producing 2/3 of human misery. This has to be noted. I will quote from one of the master's letter, where he's saying, "I will point out the greatest, the chief cause of nearly 2/3 of the evil that pursue humanity. It is religion. It is religion under whatever form and in whatever nation. It is the sacerdotal caste, the priesthood, and the churches. It is in those illusions that man looks upon as sacred that he has to search out the source of that multitude of evils which is the great curse of humanity and that almost overwhelms mankind. Ignorance created gods, and the cunning took advantage of the opportunity. Look at India, and look at the Christendom and Islam, at Judaism and fetishism. It is priestly imposture that rendered these gods so terrible to man. It is religion that makes of him the selfish bigot, the fanatic that hates all mankind out of his own sect without rendering him any better or more moral for it. It is belief in God and gods that make 2/3 of humanity the slaves of a handful of those who deceive them under the false pretense of saving them. Is not man ever ready to commit any kind of evil if told that his god or gods demand the crime? Voluntary victim of an illusionary god, the abject slave of his crafty ministers? The Irish, Italian, Slovenian peasant will starve himself and see his family starving and naked to feed and clothe his padre and pope. For 2000 years, India has groaned under the weight of caste, Brahmins alone feeding on the fat of the land, and today the followers of Christ and those of Muhammad are cutting each other's throats in the name of and for the great glory of their respective myths. Remember, the sum of human misery will never be diminished unto that day when the better portion of humanity destroys in the name of truth, morality, and universal charity the altars of their false gods." So we'll stop here.